This is Vulnerability Matters from the Money Advice Trust.
And it honestly blows my mind that when I say that we should do the right things, feels like I'm saying something really radical. And I just think we need to take a step back and think, do we really want to sustain systems that create bad outcomes for the most vulnerable people in society? And to me, it just feels like common sense, but it feels like when you're saying it, it's revolutionary.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Vulnerability Matters. I'm Chris Fitch. What if I told you that the lowest income households in the UK were often paying the very highest prices out of everyone? And what if I said that whether it was gas or electricity, car or home insurance, or even the basic weekly food shopping, that the lowest income households in our society frequently still paid hidden charges for their everyday essentials? And what if I added that this poverty premium wasn't just a steady trend in the UK economy, but actually accelerated by 75% in the last 4 years? Well, like me, you'd probably want to find out a bit more. So I spoke with Rebecca Deegan, director at Fair by Design, and asked her to explain the UK poverty premium and to share further insights from a new report on this topic that were published just this week by Fair by Design and the University of Bristol's Personal Finance Research Centre. Rebecca, welcome to Vulnerability Matters. Really great to have you here. We're here to talk about your new research, and it's part of a milestone series that's been tracking the poverty premium. I can't quite believe this, from 2016 onwards to 2026, and that's the fourth wave. But for anyone who's new to this decade of research, what exactly is the poverty premium and how does it affect our everyday lives?
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me to talk about our latest research on the poverty premium, which is the extra cost that people on low incomes face for the everyday essentials of modern life. And this isn't a niche issue. This new research shows that 95% of low-income households pay at least one poverty premium. If you want to pay for your energy once you receive your bill because you want greater control over your spending than if you have a direct debit set up, you're charged over £130 more a year. If you've got no choice but to pay monthly for your car or home insurance, you're charged extra for that, which can drive up the cost for the same amount of cover. And if you need to borrow money, you're often charged significantly higher rates of interest, which means you end up paying more back than you borrowed. So it's just really simply, if you've got less money, too often you end up paying more for the exact same thing.
Okay. Your research defines a low-income household as living on 70% or less of the UK median income after housing costs. Why is this specific baseline so key to understanding the financial trade-offs that families are forced to make every single day?
So from the get-go, we have defined low-income households as those with an income of 70% of median income or below after housing costs. And put simply, this captures households whose income is less than 70% of what a typical household earns. And this definition is intentionally higher than the standard poverty line measure of 60% of median income, because we want to capture households both below the poverty line and just above the poverty line, because those households are still under a huge amount of financial pressure and constantly having to make impossible trade-offs. And some of the trade-offs that they're having to make include putting the heating on versus feeding their family. We recently had a session with our lived experience panel, and it's hard to imagine this during the heat wave that we're experiencing now, but more than a good number of them told us that they hadn't put their heating on a single time this winter, and this winter was long and bleak and cold.
Okay. For the statistically minded out there, they do live amongst us. The median UK household income after housing costs is around £32,500. So 70% of that figure means that we're talking about low-income households with an annual income of around £22,750 or less. Now, there was a really key finding from your research, Rebecca, in terms of the poverty premium. In 2022, the average poverty premium was £217, but by 2026, it was £380. Now, drawing on my comprehensive school maths, which I probably shouldn't do, I reckon that's a 75% increase in a very short period of time. So what's driving this, Rebecca, and what does it mean for low-income household budgets?
Yeah, this increase reflects both rising costs and important shifts in how the poverty premium's experienced. There are also a couple of changes in methodology, which I'm not going to talk to you about because there's a 12-page appendix. But the point stands, it has still increased massively and it's caused by several factors. So the food-related poverty premium now accounts for £103 of their £380 average. And this is now one of the costliest poverty premiums, whereas before it was one of the smaller poverty premiums. So that's been the largest increase since 2022 and 2026. The insurance poverty premium has always been the costliest poverty premium, continues to be the costliest poverty premium. That's £129 on average for affected households. The energy poverty premium's also gone up. Credit poverty premium's come down. So there's a little bit of good news. The credit poverty premium is now £52 for households. And I think it's just key to point out that even though 95% of low-income households are affected, and this is the average for those 95%, there's actually a really wide variance. So one quarter of households in poverty pay over £500 extra a year, and one in 10 pay over £700 extra a year. And factors such as household size and household composition, housing tenure, age, ethnicity, and levels of digital access all influence where you are in that spread. And it means that households who already have the least amount of money available to pay for the bills are not only being hit by the cost of living crisis that we're all facing, they're facing an extra burden, the poverty premium, and that's putting households under immense strain.
And we've seen a lot of research on premiums or the extra cost of living, haven't we? Like the ethnicity premium, the disability premiums, the digital premium, the gender premium, the longevity premium. I could go on with the list. So in your opinion, what is the relationship between all of these premiums and the poverty premium itself? Are they a distraction or do we need them all?
Yeah, I think these premiums are all interconnected. They're absolutely not competing concepts. People living in poverty are not a homogenous group, and our research shows that people with different protected characteristics experience a poverty premium differently. And this year we added an ethnicity boost to the survey because we really want to contribute to efforts to better understand the ethnicity premium. And we found that white respondents were the least likely ethnic group to incur every single poverty premium, except from one, home contents insurance. And that's because Asian, Black and mixed ethnicity households were less likely to have contents insurance in the first place because they were just priced out of that market.
Okay, let's ground ourselves in the data a little bit more. So let's look at energy. Can you give us a few more findings that you had there?
Yeah, sure. So the energy poverty premium is the most complicated, but 59% of low-income households incur some form of the energy poverty premium. And there are two main factors at play. One is whether you're on the best tariff, and one is how you choose to pay for your bills. And this research shows that households who pay for their energy via prepayment meter face a poverty premium of £129. And that's despite Ofgem rules mean that prepayment meter customers shouldn't be facing significantly higher standing charges compared to direct debit customers because they use that payment method.
Go from energy then to insurance. And it says that you found three different types of poverty premiums when it comes to insurance.
So the insurance poverty premium is one of the most widespread poverty premiums. 7 out of 10 households pay an insurance-related poverty premium. So the three are location-based pricing, payment method, and then single-item insurance. So location-based pricing, people living in more deprived areas often face significantly higher premiums, particularly for motor insurance, due to postcode-based risk assessments. And risk assessment is absolutely fundamental to insurance. But the way that this is then priced into premiums reinforces existing inequalities because risk is managed without any consideration for what that means for affordability for people on low income. So that's one of the things that we're seeing happening. The other is payment methods. So many households can't afford to pay up front for their insurance premiums, especially if they're going up. And so they opt to pay monthly through premium finance arrangements. A lot of people don't realize they're actually entering a finance arrangement when they pay monthly that has extra costs. And this effectively means that households who don't have the savings to pay up front end up paying more overall in order to pay monthly. And then last but not least, the single item insurance product. So for cover things like appliances, how important that can be, or to insure your mobile phone. And they're typically expensive for what they are. And they're more commonly used by low-income households because of that fear of something breaking down and them not having savings to replace it. And that's one of the highest poverty premiums for people on low incomes in relation to insurance. And I think what's not captured in these figures, but is really concerning and is in the body of the report, is that because the insurance poverty premium has been so high for so long, we're actually seeing increased rates of underinsurance or just people not taking out insurance at all. And that's really problematic because it increases their financial vulnerability. If an unexpected event like an accident, a theft or damage happens, that can lead to really severe economic hardship.
Let's have a look at food shopping. Nearly 2 in 5 low-income households incurred a poverty premium on their basic shopping. I mean, can you just say a bit more about what's happening here?
Yeah, we were really surprised by that result. And honestly, it's something we need to do more to understand in detail because it hasn't previously been a key focus for us because it hasn't been a high poverty premium before. Essentially, the research method looks at the difference in cost for a basket of groceries in larger and local versions of the same supermarkets. And it also looks at what proportion of low-income households shopping they're doing in either of those types of stores. And so what we're seeing is both that the price difference between local and large stores is increasing, the overall cost of food is increasing, and yet people on low incomes are doing a greater proportion of their shopping in those local higher cost stores. And we really don't know why that is from the research that we've done, but it's something that we really want to do more research into. There's quite a lot of research out there about food deserts and that it can be hard to access these larger supermarkets, but we're not sure that that explains the uptick in why people are shopping at those stores and also the uptick in the difference between those two stores as well. So loads for us to get our teeth into to really understand the food poverty premium better.
Certainly something going on there. It's it looks like it's a little bit more than just paying more for convenience. There's an underlying kind of driver there. There was also a fascinating poverty premium that was found in relation to access to money and cash. Tell us a bit more about this.
So the money and cash premium is mainly driven by the credit-related poverty premium. So can low-income households access affordable credit? And over a quarter of low-income households are paying high rates of interest on credit. This poverty premium affects fewer households than other poverty premiums because of several regulatory interventions. But those it does affect, it's a really huge cost. So like only 1% of survey respondents used subprime loans, which can have APRs as high as 50%. But for that 1%, the poverty premium's over £800 a year. And for the 1% using short-term payday loans, it's nearly £700 a year. So for affected households, it's like super high cost.
Now, we've had quite a lot of statistics so far, Rebecca. So before we dive into the second half of our conversation, where we're going to look at some of the solutions to the poverty premium, could you just bring this first half to a close with a lived experience insight?
I think to really bring it to life, if I could tell you about Sam, who's an original member of our lived experience panel. She is a single parent, as sadly her partner and her son Oscar's dad passed away in 2023. She works a full-time job, but her job is so low paid that she also receives universal credit. And in 2018, her washing machine broke and she was turned down for interest-free credit to buy a new one, which led to her sourcing a second-hand one. And you might say, it's only a washing machine. But at that time, her son had just finished chemotherapy and he'd undergone his second bone marrow transplant. And due to this, her son was classed as immunocompromised. So she'd been told that all of her bedding, towels, clothing had to be washed every day at 60 degrees. And it took some time to source the second-hand washing machine and get it delivered. And she had to resort to wheeling the washing in a suitcase to her friend's house who lived in a neighbouring village on foot. because she lives in a really rural area with poor public transport links. And as if that wasn't bad enough, then a couple of months later, her boiler broke and she needed to get that fixed immediately because another side effect of the chemotherapy is that her son really feels the cold, and she couldn't source a boiler secondhand. So this time she did take out a loan, but it's got such a high rate of interest that she's still paying that loan off. And by the time she's paid it off, she'll have paid three times more than that boiler would have cost her if she could pay up front.
Now, clearly, Rebecca, Sam's experiences and the millions of people in similar situations to Sam really drives your work to create markets, services, products that are indeed fair by design. So in terms of the poverty premium, I wonder what an essential service market that was, in quotes, fair by design, would actually look like.
Right now, there are lots of barriers to accessing the best deals, whether that's digital access, not wanting to pay for things via direct debit, needing to build a long credit history, or having a steady and predictable income. And there are also factors such as where you live and geopolitics that affect the cost of essentials for everyone, but in particular for low-income households because of the poverty premium. And a system that was fair by default wouldn't penalise people because of these barriers and factors. This might sound like a bit of a theoretical alien concept, but it absolutely isn't. We've seen glimpses of systems being changed to be fair by default. So the Ofgem rule that I mentioned earlier around levelling energy costs between prepayment customers and direct debit customers is a good example of this. And in the longer term, we want to see government go even further and introduce a social tariff so that if you're on a low income and you're eligible, your energy bills are just lower by default anyway, because we've created this system where if you're on a low income, you pay more. And if you're more affluent, you pay less, which just, you know, doesn't seem fair at all, or even just common sense. And I think, in a nutshell, if these markets were designed, you know, to reverse that, then that would be fair. But also, that is entirely achievable. We just need the political and regulatory will to make that happen.
So, Rebecca, I think I know what the answer to this is going to be, but here goes. Here's the question anyway. So, looking at the entire picture, is the poverty premium a failure of market regulation, Ofgem, the FCA, other regulators? Or is it more of a symptom of a social security system or welfare net that's inadequate?
Yeah, it's both. I think, crucially, though, we can't use one as an excuse to avoid fixing the other, which can often feel like what's happening when we're speaking to regulators and policymakers to tackle the poverty premium. If I start with regulation, as we've spoken about that a bit already, we don't think regulators are adequately considering low-income consumers' interests. Now, they do a lot of work on vulnerable customers, and we've seen positive changes. So I don't want to give the impression that regulators are blind to this issue and they're not doing anything, because that's not true. But Ofgem, the FCA and others were largely designed to promote competition and market efficiency. And increasingly, there's pressure on them to achieve economic growth. And yes, they do also have objectives to protect consumers, but it definitely feels like the weighting between all of those isn't certainly where we would like to see it. And that means that, in our view, that they're not doing enough. And it's really frustrating, because we've seen that regulatory action can have a really significant and positive effect on the poverty premium. And so we do want to see more regulatory intervention, because it is effective. But you're absolutely right. We have to talk about social security and also just the political will to tackle these issues head on. The reason the poverty premium bites so hard is because people have such little wiggle room with their finances, like people in low-paid and secured work, people who experience ill health that leads to a period of unemployment. You know, they can find themselves in a situation where they don't have enough money to meet essential costs. And this is because the minimum wage isn't high enough compared to living costs. And this is because working age benefits aren't high enough compared to living costs. And the poverty premium really compounds that, because it makes the cost of living even higher for low-income households, which is exerting even more pressure on families who are really struggling.
We've had a decade of reports on the poverty premium. Can you share some successes in that time that maybe our government, regulators or firms have achieved in tackling the structural extra costs of being poor? Any slivers of hope Rebecca, yeah, for us.
There are some slivers of hope. You know, we've had 4 Bristol of University reports. We've had Fabian Society analysis. We've had parliamentary inquiries. We've been doing our best to campaign. Like, what do we have to show for all of this activity? Fair question. And we do have some genuine wins that are really meaningful in and of themselves. Absolutely not enough to eliminate the poverty premium. This report shows that the poverty premium is deeper and wider than it has ever been. So, like, this is not a success story overall. But we do need to look at those successes, because, and actually the things where we're still struggling to create change, because there's really important lessons, and it's giving us a really clear steer on what we need to do as a campaign and what we can say to the rest of the economic justice movement about what we think we all need to call for to improve socioeconomic inequality. And the clearest wins I've mentioned, so I won't go into them in detail, but we've got the prepayment meters, we've got legacy premiums, ban on acquisition only tariffs, we've got improvements in free access to cash, we've got a cap on the cost of credit, we've got reductions in premium finance. You know, all of these show what I was just saying, regulatory intervention backed by political will can work without destabilizing markets, because that's one of the pushbacks we get quite a lot. The market will be destabilized. It won't. We've shown it won't. These things have come in. The markets are fine. But despite these wins, this report shows that not only are people paying more, and more people are paying more, that actually a lot of people are being completely priced out of markets. Nearly 1 in 5 respondents to the survey said that they've gone without home contents insurance because they can't afford it. And 1 in 50 have self-disconnected from gas and energy to reduce their energy bills. And so I think that's not good for industry. You know, that's not good for anybody. Industry's losing out on money from people who are not paying for their services, as well as it not being good for individuals.
Last question. There's one thing we want to leave ringing in the heads and the ears of our listeners about the poverty premium. Regardless of where they work, regardless of what they do, what would be the one thing that you'd want them to take away?
Yeah, I think the single most important thing is to make your products and services inclusive by design and embed inclusive design principles and lived experience input across your business. I'm not asking you to bring in a special scheme, a hardship fund, a single discounted project with lots of eligibility criteria and a complex application form. Make your products and services fair by default, where the deal that customers get automatically is the best deal for them. I think we can see from the 2026 report that this is absolutely not the case. There's so many ways that markets are not inclusive by design, and really changing that ethos, as lofty as it is, from thinking about inclusion as a bolt-on rather than the starting point, is the most effective and whole system way to change the poverty premium. And I was speaking about, like, the commercial case for doing this, like brand loyalty and having more customers. But I think the honest truth is that for most firms, eliminating the poverty premium is going to cost something, at least in the short term, because some of these pricing differentials exist because they're profitable. But I don't think we should shy away from that. And it honestly blows my mind that when I say that we should do the right thing and be inclusive by design rather than it be a bolt-on, that it feels like I'm saying something really radical or something really naive. And I just think we need to take a step back and think, do we really want to sustain systems that create bad outcomes for the most vulnerable people in society, trapping them in debt cycles, poverty, all of the poor health and life outcomes that come from being trapped in poverty, when we've got the means and the knowledge to design a system that creates better outcomes for people and the planet? I mean, and to me, it just feels like common sense, but it feels like when you're saying it, it's revolutionary.
Maybe that's what common sense is. Rebecca Deegan, thank you very much. And that was Rebecca Deegan, Director at Fair by Design, talking about their new research on the poverty premium, which is a collaboration with the University of Bristol's Personal Finance Research Centre and the very talented research duo of Jamie Evans and Sarah Davis. You can get the research report that Rebecca was talking about at fairbydesign.com or you can search for PFRC, University of Bristol, to get access to report there and a whole host of other resources too. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. As always, you can listen to this episode again, why not, treat yourself, or our whole back catalogue by rummaging in the usual places. But as an added bonus for you, if you search SoundCloud Vulnerability Matters, you can also download every single episode as an MP3 file too. So feel free to plonk them all on your intranet or slice them up for team huddles or training sessions. So until next time, keep on slicing, keep on plonking, but most of all, keep on remembering that vulnerability matters. Vulnerability Matters was brought to you by the Money Advice Trust. It was presented by Chris Fitch and produced by Phil King.